Welcome to TWIL, The Week in Health Law, the high deductible podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on January 19th, 2016. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. And my co-host is
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
And this week on TWIL, we're pleased to welcome Jessica Roberts, Professor of Law and Director of the Health Law and Policy Institute at the University of Houston Law Center. Professor Roberts specializes in health law, disability law, and genetics in the law. Big welcome, Jessica.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
First, some things that are lying around my desk and Frank's desk. The very first thing I wanted to raise, and it's much in my mind because I'm speaking at a conference in Nashville at Vanderbilt on Friday on the Internet of Health Things. And one of the things I was going to mention was cybersecurity, particularly with regard to medical devices. And the FDA has just released yet another non-binding recommendation or guidance to industry and its staff with regard to post-market management, i.e. sort of surveillance of medical devices. I think it's an important piece of the puzzle as the FDA tries to get its head around the safety and security issues associated with medical devices, more so traditional HIT at the moment than they've shown real activity in the mobile wearable space, but at least something that is moving along. And also, I think raises sort of a regulatory policy issue that Frank and I have discussed here on TWIL before, which is just how effective these guidances are as opposed to either hands-off completely or regular regulation, whether in fact these guidances actually tend to create ambiguity rather than drive the industry forward across or along a path of innovation. I don't know what you think about that, Frank.
I think it is a very critical issue. And I think that, you know, this is many of these agencies just face such resource constraints. You know, I'm thinking of Efthymi Parasitis's article, Patients Before Profits, where he described in great detail a lot of the constraints that the FDA faces. So I feel like I may echo your views with respect to the FTC from last week, Nick, and say that, you know, given the difficult constraints that the agency is under, this may be about the best that they can do in terms of this piecemeal approach. And I really look forward to reading this guidance. And for my contribution to our lightning round, I wanted to bring up a story that was in Kaiser Health News. And this was a story that was essentially discussing the difficulties that lots of people are facing on the exchanges in terms of the out-of-pocket expenditures that they may be expected to put forward for co-pays, deductibles, co-insurance, etc., that some people on the exchanges have found that the bills can take up to 25% of income. And I don't want to go through all of the statistics here right now. I will link to the article on the show page, but I wanted to contextualize this study with Allison Hoffman's excellent article in the North Carolina Law Review from last year, which I'll also link to, talking about financial security after the Affordable Care Act. And I really admire Allison's efforts to typologize exactly what types of financial issues could arise for people, first on employer-sponsored insurance, then on the exchange plans, and also on Medicare. And I know there's other works out there on Medicaid. And I think that as we drill down into health policy and debate, say, in the Democratic primaries or other political contexts, how to improve the Affordable Care Act, thinking about each of these different buckets of the insured is going to be really critical to an informed public debate.
It's almost a sort of a party time for progressives as health policy and our healthcare system suddenly seems to be being debated again. The issue of the single payer system has come back into the headlines. And there's a really interesting piece by Chicago's Harold Pollack, writing in Vox last week, in which he basically describes the let's go to single payer, you know, Medicare for all kind of approach as a caricature of what a real single payer system would look like. And I have to admit that I have been guilty on occasion, sometimes in a classroom perhaps, of saying, you know, we could have avoided all this Affordable Care Act nonsense and all this controversy if we just struck out the age requirement for Medicare. And Pollack's very good at explaining just what moving to a single payer system would mean in the US, even assuming that there was the political will, the turmoil among stakeholders would be extraordinary. That was kind of reinforced a little bit for me when I came across one of a series of wonderful new posts at The Guardian in the UK on the UK's National Health Service. And I warmly recommend anyone who wants to do a deep dive into some comparative health law, comparative health policy, and financing systems and so on to take a look. But one of the fascinating stats they came up there was that the UK National Health Service is the fifth largest employer in the world. And let's face it, the UK is not a huge country. It's large, but it's not huge. Its top five workforce comes only after the US Department of Defense, McDonald's, Walmart, and the Chinese People's Liberation Army. And unlike at least some of those, I think the National Health Service actually has full-time employees. Those issues raised by those two pieces got a very nice capstone from a piece by Jared Bernstein in The Post, also towards the end of last week or over the weekend, in which he sort of took the position that it's great talking about all these alternatives to the ACA, but maybe we should also talk about just how much progress we've made having the ACA. And in his words, ask the candidates, how are you going to protect it from the marauding hordes that would destroy it?
I love that phraseology. And I do think that, you know, at present, in the primary debates, the marauding horde seems to be characterized as those who would radically change the ACA or go for single payer. But I'm going to focus my discussion on another marauding horde, which would be the some of the corporations and insurance companies behaving badly, and which I think is going to make it very difficult to sell the act. Looking back to Bill Sage's article about called Brand New Law, How to Market the ACA, I think that some of the corporate actors are making it hard to sell the ACA. And I'll give you two examples of that this week. One is a relatively recent revelation that in Texas, among those insured by Humana on exchange plans, 56% of their in-network hospitals had no in-network physicians in the emergency department. So you can imagine how confused patients are going to be, or people who are insured, if they are going to be drilling down and trying to figure out exactly who's in network, who's not, et cetera. Another case also, by the way, for Bill Sage's article on upstream healthcare and on sort of assembling healthcare as delivered products. I thought that was really borne out by that statistic. The second story that I'll bring up is a Bloomberg story talking about the eroding voluntariness of wellness programs. Just the story discussed a line of cases where essentially employees were told you need to give blood or else you need to basically give your blood to be analyzed for our various programs or else you will lose insurance coverage. And the courts have not been sticking up for employees. They've basically been allowing the employers a lot of latitude in terms of how they structure their programs, coming in under criticism from people like Sam Bagenstos and others who are experts in disability law. And so I think that this issue of both insurers behaving badly and some corporations behaving in somewhat troubling ways here also makes the PR for the ACA a little difficult. Well, if I could start in this week with asking some questions to Jessica about some of her recent work, I'd love to. And I wanted to start, actually, with an article that she had co-authored with Nicole Huberfeld called Healthcare and the Myth of Self-Reliance. I really like this article. I thought it did a fantastic job of discussing what Susan Mettler has called the submerged state, this idea that essentially lots of people are getting government benefits, but we aren't exactly forthcoming about their nature. And I was wondering, Jessica, if you could describe the inspiration for this article and some of your arguments in it.
Absolutely, I would love to. So this article grew out of a longer-term collaboration between me and Nicole, who is, as you all know, she's a Medicaid devotee. And I personally had experience with the Medicaid system when my father was ill and dying, and we had to get him on Medicaid in Texas, which is no small task. And I had the revelation that Medicaid is actually something that is stepping in as a kind of universal benefit, right? That most people, if you don't have a lot of money or really fantastic long-term care insurance, chances are you are going to end up needing Medicaid if you live long enough. And I started a conversation with Nicole about that. And we really came to this realization that Medicaid is this crucial part of what we call the Affordable Care Act's principle of universality. This notion that what Congress was doing was it was piecing together universal healthcare coverage, and that all parts of this patchwork are essential. And so we wrote a couple shorter articles about Medicaid, but it really all culminated in this recent article, Healthcare and the Myth of Self-Reliance, which, knock on wood, will be out in the Boston College Law Review later this month. We approved the galleys, so we're looking forward to seeing it in print. And we were really struck by the different outcomes that we saw in terms of King and in NFIB, right? And the way in which the Supreme Court dealt with two different, yet in our minds, related kinds of programs for poor and near poor Americans, right? And the fact that Medicaid expansion is something that the court was willing to say could be, you know, on a voluntary basis, right? Whereas, you know, there was much more support for the low-income subsidy. And so we set out to think about, you know, why is it that two programs that more or less serve the same populations, why there's support for one and disdain for the other? And we arrived at this notion of, you know, self-reliance and what it means to be a good American. And that despite the realities, right, that Medicaid recipients, that many of them are themselves workers or at least members of working households, that there's this notion that folks that receive government benefits are not good workers and are not good Americans. And so we set out to debunk this myth of self-reliance, that, you know, that good Americans work and get private health insurance and bad Americans shirk and get Medicaid. And that is how this project came about. And so basically our argument here is that, you know, no one is truly self-reliant, right, in terms of, you know, we're all interdependent, we're all vulnerable to disease and injury. This is Martha Feynman's theory of universal vulnerability. But also if you look at the numbers in terms of who are the folks that are receiving the low-income subsidy and are on Medicaid, there's this phenomenon of churn, really, and it can be only the difference between a few days' pay for whether or not you're getting private subsidized insurance or whether or not you're on Medicaid. And so that treating these programs, having two separate programs serving more or less the same populations, doesn't make sense. So our big argument at the end was, you know, whether or not it's some sort of private subsidized coverage or whether or not it's universal Medicaid, we should have a single unified program to allow poor Americans to have health insurance. How is that as a summary?
That is a fantastic summary. I really appreciate that, Jessica. Okay. And I think, you know, that's one of our, I think one of the most difficult things for people that sort of do the deep dive and try to distill years of thought. And clearly this article is just fantastic in terms of its ability to really bring together a lot of different strands about the nature of distributive justice and the nature of people's reliance on the state. And I really appreciate your summarizing it like so well and so quickly. I guess the one question that I would have as a follow-up would be, in terms of this sort of unified approach, I do think that's critical, because one of the things that I worry about so much with the Affordable Care Act is, it's actually a critique that was levied by Corey Robin, who said, you know, people just don't have time for all the paperwork. You know how Oscar Wilde once said that socialism would be great except for all the meetings? You know, and I feel like the same thing sort of arises with the Affordable Care Act and its complexity, is that people just may not have time to figure out, oh, what's my income this month or all the rest. And I'm wondering, do you think that ultimately technology is going to play some sort of role in enabling further complexity in terms of different tiers of coverage or types of coverage or categories? Or do you think that ultimately we're going to need this type of unification because even if technology advances, it's just going to be out of the reach of the average enrollee?
So I think the latter, that even that technology does have important equalizing forces. And in fact, there's a quick plug for the University of Houston Law Center and some of the work that our Health Law and Policy Institute is doing. Is one of the things we're interested in is working with the FCC to increase broadband access for folks in need of healthcare services. And so this idea that technology could be a vehicle for providing health services to lower income folks. And in fact, this is a reality. One of the things that we have happening in Houston right now is actually our fire department, when responding to emergency phone calls, is coming in with iPads. And then, so instead of taking you straight to the ER, they're doing a little quick intake with a doctor. And then if it's not a true emergency, you know, you can schedule a follow-up and they're arranging transportation. So I think that is a fantastic example of the way in which technology can be used to create better healthcare delivery, especially when you consider that a lot of the folks that are making those 911 emergency calls are folks that are using, you know, ERs as their primary healthcare provider. So I think that there's some promise there. But as you were saying, Frank, my concern, right, is that the technology won't be equally available to everyone, and that there are serious administrative as well as economic losses that are associated with having the same populations bounce back and forth between private insurance and Medicaid. Because once you figure out the benefits of one program, a relatively small shift in your pay could bump you to another program, or even in some states leave you uninsured. And it can be very difficult for people to navigate that. So even with the help of all of these exciting technologies, I do still think that we're going to end up needing some kind of a unified system.
Well, I'd like to move the conversation over to another article that you have coming out, co-authored with friend of the show, Elizabeth Leonard. And it's about something you label healthism. And you pose the question, quote, when does the government or private actors classify according to health status in a way that results in a normative wrong? And I suppose and I've heard Elizabeth talk on health rhetoric before. And there is a rhetoric of healthisms, health-related stereotypes. We refer to the sick, the ill, the sterile, the dying. And in years past, unfortunately, to the insane, the mentally defective, and so on and so forth. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your current sense of what healthism is and the kind of structure and conceptualization of it that led you to this really fascinating article.
Absolutely. So your question, the point of departure in terms of this notion of, you know, the sick, the defective, the ill, the insane, it really highlights the fact that health is not just some sort of biological functionalist category, right? Health has really deep normative social meaning as well. Elizabeth and I have been thinking about this idea of healthism for some time, ever since actually she reviewed an article I wrote in the Illinois Law Review. She wrote she pushed back on me a little bit in a Jotwell entry, and we've just had a fantastic conversation ever since. The ACA was really cast in a lot of the rhetoric as a civil rights bill for the sick. And so what inspired me to think about this notion of healthism is, you know, what does it mean to have a civil rights bill for the sick? Do the sick need a civil rights bill? And so I came up with this concept of healthism, that is discrimination on the basis of health. And Elizabeth pushed back on me and said, well, you have to acknowledge, right, that some health-based differentiations are actually good things, right? So not all classifications on the basis of health can be this thing you're calling healthism that is discriminatory. And so then we embarked on this journey to try to distinguish the good socially beneficial health status distinctions from these socially problematic, arguably discriminatory health-based distinctions. And so that's what we're attempting to do in this article, What Is and Isn't Healthism, that we have coming out in the Georgia Law Review, is we're trying to create some sort of a rubric for distinguishing between health status differentiations that have a purpose and health status differentiations that are discriminatory.
One of the key sort of dichotomies that the two of you seem to play with in this, really what's a fascinating dialogue between the two of you in this essay, which I warmly recommend, is you raise the distinction between what you call the anti-subordination rationale and the anti-classification rationale. And a lot of what sort of follows in the paper falls off that distinction. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Anti-subordination versus anti-classification is well-worn territory within anti-discrimination theory. And it gets to what should the goal of anti-discrimination law and policy be? So when we set out to stop discrimination, what are we doing? How do we define discrimination? And anti-subordination theory says that anti-discrimination law and policy should seek to eradicate any sort of social subjugation of historically disadvantaged groups. And in so doing, anti-subordination, it also targets unintentional discrimination in addition to it, intentional discrimination. And anti-subordination also favors positive differential treatment, that is something like affirmative action. And you can contrast anti-subordination theory with this notion of anti-classification, which holds that the classification in and of itself is the problem. And so you want to outlaw all intentional classifications on the basis of a protected trait. And so in that way, anti-classification does not capture unintentional discrimination, and it also does not allow for positive differential treatment. And so this question is, if we're going to define healthism, that is, if we're going to create a new anti-discrimination category for health, should we adopt an anti-subordination approach that deals with elevating the social status of a subordinated group? Or should we adopt an anti-classification kind of distinction that would say, okay, any intentional consideration of health would be problematic? And Elizabeth and I both agreed that anti-classification would throw the baby out with the bathwater, that actually healthism, if it's going to be a meaningful concept, was going to need more nuance than that. And so we needed to look at social standing and subordination and think about the normative wrong of discrimination opposed to just relying on the classification itself as the problem.
So when I looked at your lists of the good and the bad that you got to towards the end of the article, I saw something of a linkage to a concept that Frank and I and others in sort of the data space have discussed quite a lot, which is data determinism. That individuals who are subject to, for example, big data brokers who have tons of information about them are able to create situations where sort of the data takes over and the individual no longer has any control. I wondered how close that concept came to your idea of the bad forms of healthism, that essentially the kinds of discriminatory practices that you two identify tend to be cases where really the individual has no control, cannot make any better decisions, cannot make better outcomes. And therefore, there's a sort of a determinism that they are incapable of, as individuals, of affecting.
Yes, so I think that there's definitely an element in terms of, well, particularly when you think of the role of paternalism in some of these health-based classifications. So going back to something that Frank mentioned at the start of the show, right, employers having insurance policies that say we want to take your blood for biometric testing and that's going to have an effect on your health insurance. And if you don't do this biometric testing, you're either going to, you know, pay a significantly higher premium or maybe you don't even get health insurance at all, right? And so that has this kind of coercive element to it. And so that is a big thing that we tackle in the paper is the role of paternalism, because we don't dismiss paternalism as something that is just outright in and of itself bad. We recognize the fact that some paternalistic policies can be socially beneficial, and we acknowledge the possibility of nudges and those kinds of things that can then, you know, move folks to make better health decisions, but we're wary of them for exactly the reason that you were saying, that we have to be careful what we assume is voluntary conduct, right? And so you could look at someone who is significantly overweight and say, okay, you know, you're overweight because of your own quote unquote bad health choices. But then if you consider maybe that person lives in a food desert and doesn't have access to healthy food, maybe that person can't afford healthy food, maybe that person doesn't have the time or the resources to exercise, then all of a sudden you basically can't nudge someone to make a better decision if there's not a meaningful choice. And so I think in that way, the determinism is really relevant. But that said, you know, we don't rely too heavily in anti-discrimination law. There's this concept of immutability, right? And immutability is being a lack of fault. And we do try to shy away from immutability a little bit because, you know, because there is such ambiguity between what is a choice and what isn't a choice. So we're wary of choices. And I think that the absence of true, meaningful choice and determinism is really a key part of our project.
Yes. And I think well said that controlling choice architecture is great, but you do have to have choices for that to make any sense. So as a productive scholar, both you and Elizabeth are incredibly productive, smart scholars. As you have started work on the book or thinking about the book, I'm sure like all the best professional writers, you're actually writing the final chapter first and working backwards from that. So give us a hint as to what kind of recommendations the healthism analysis is going to lead to.
Oh, fantastic. So you get a preview of it in the essay that we're publishing with the Georgia Law Review in terms of what we want to do is we want to go through and really take a deep dive into these potentially good health, what we call health promoting classifications, right? So classifications that would encourage healthy decision making, that would facilitate individual choice regarding health, that would lower risks, that would lower costs, and that would facilitate better care and better access. And so, you know, an example of one of those might be participation-based employer-provided wellness programs that include a smoking cessation program. So what we hope to do in at least one of those later chapters is to go through and say, hey, look, here are all of the things that are clearly not healthist. They're health-based classifications, but they are doing good and they are useful. Right. So that's one part of the end of the book. The next part is these more challenging, you know, healthist classifications that we think the law should actually step in and perhaps regulate. Right. So any sort of health based classification that's driven by animus. Right. That isn't really about promoting health or improving people's standing. And, you know, there's animus. The best example is, you know, people do not like smokers, right? And so even if it's something that is against an unpopular group like smokers, we're deeply skeptical of animus-driven classifications, also classifications that create stigma or punish people for their private conduct or impede access to care or actually might limit choice or produce worse health outcomes. Or perpetuate health disparities. And so then we'll go through and talk more about the kinds of healthist conduct. The paradigmatic example of that being the nicotine use bans that I described in an earlier article in the Iowa Law Review, where I came up with this idea of healthism and employment. Because really, you know, banning nicotine users from working in a particular place, that doesn't seem to be linked to their job qualifications, right? If you can say there's some reason why this person is not qualified, that's a different story. But if it's just something in terms of, you know, we don't like the idea that you're going to be using this particular substance, which is a legal substance, I should point out, that's potentially problematic. And so in our conclusion, I think what we're planning on doing is just summing up those basic findings and offering this rubric. And it's our hope that this rubric will be something that's not only academically interesting, but it might also be something that could help those courts that are deciding those biometric cases that Frank was discussing. Because health-based classifications continue to be a contentious issue. And we hope that we can create some sort of a framework that will be both interesting from the perspective of legal scholarship, but that will also be helpful to law and policymakers in navigating which kinds of classifications are helpful and good and which kinds are problematic.
And Frank, to tie back to your lightning round wellness piece, here, Jessica and Elizabeth have a great sentence, quote, "By discriminating based on age, tobacco use, and geography, insurers can recreate most of the price tiers that they customarily imposed pre-ACA." And I think, Jessica, that's another huge part of your project.
Absolutely. So this was one of the concerns that I had when I embarked on my healthism project, really when I started writing and teaching. The Affordable Care Act had passed recently, and there was all this this civil rights rhetoric, civil rights for the sick, and this notion that we're going to move away from looking at individual risk. We're going to move away from these pre-existing condition exclusions. And at least in the individual and small group markets, I was deeply skeptical of that because, if you're considering geographic location, age, tobacco use, these are all proxies for health. And so it seems as though even though we're trying to move away from health status-based distinctions in health insurance, they keep creeping back in as long as we have a private for-profit system, right? Because those insurance companies need something to base their decisions on. And so we might be ending up not with health explicitly, but with proxies for health. And that could have the same kinds of impacts if we were just considering the health statuses themselves in the first place.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A special thank you to Professor Roberts for joining us today. Professor Roberts is at JROBERTSUHLC on Twitter. Great fun having you with us, Jessica.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
We post our show notes at twill.com. If you have a moment, please go to iTunes and rate the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry. That's Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be reached this week?
I'm at HealthPI on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us and have a legally interesting but healthy week.